Beyond the Tenth by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 5. If you could see the letters I receive and keep on seeing them over more than a decade, you would come to one inescapable conclusion. Readers are queer people. Not you, of course, but all the other readers, or rather some of them, because some are very, very nice indeed. One constant type of comment I get is that I should send more copies of my books free to public libraries. People write in and tell me they can't afford the price for my paperback books, and they can only read, they tell me, if I supply them free to libraries. Well, I'm not much in favor of that idea. An author makes his only living from royalties on books. If I write a book, I get 10% of the profit. 10% in some countries, 7% in others, and always on the lowest selling price. If a book is sent from England, where it is very low priced, to America, where it has to bear the cost of shipping, etc., I do not get the royalties on the higher American price. I get the royalties on the lower English price. Royalties on the profit, mind you, after all expenses have been taken off by the publisher. I also have to pay an agent or two agents, and sometimes from my 10%, I have to pay 20% in agents' fees. Then there are taxes, and an author, all too frequently, encounters double taxation. That is, he pays full tax in one country and then has to pay tax on the same sum of money in another country. And, believe me, that knocks all the gilt off the gingerbread, and you end up with hardly any bread at all. In addition, I have to pay quite a lot of other things, stationery, envelopes, stamps. And let me remind you also that an author who answers letters is the worst paid man in the world. A buck navvy who leisurely digs a hole in a road is paid for his work. He's paid for his time. A lawyer is paid for his time and his skill, and so is a doctor. But people write to an author actually demanding this or that service, or this or that gift, and 9 times out of 10, they don't even enclose return postage. If they do, it is all too frequently postage from another country. For example, people in America who send stamped addressed envelopes put American stamps on which, of course, cannot be used in a sovereign state such as Canada. So what is one to do then? Pay the cost of the stationery, the printing of the letter heading? Some letters have to be typed. That again costs money, and the postage has to be met. So, as you will agree, people write to an author and expect all for nothing. I actually had a person write to me and tell me they had bought one of my books. As such, he was entitled to my whole services, he told me. He said that he had read in the back of the book that I was asking people to write to me. It never entered his head that I was asking people not to write to me. As an author, I depend upon royalties, and if people borrow books from the public library, I do not get any payment. And yet, the ones who borrow from a public library are the ones who are most demanding in their questions and requirements. I've had a person write to me and tell me that she had read one of my books, and you may now send me complimentary autographed copies of all your books, and I want an autographed photograph of you, too. Well, what would you reply to that, dear reader? One gets various amusing incidents also. I am highly amused at the behavior of a little group of people in Adelaide, Australia. I call them the Apes of Adelaide. These are a little gang who have been in trouble, it seems, with the police. Now, I had someone write to me, telling me various things in confidence, and asking, did I recommend these people? I wrote back and said, no, I did not. Since then, I've had dozens of obscene letters from these people, and every so often I get perhaps 9 or 10 which say, I hereby disconnect from you. It strikes me as rather amusing, because we've never been connected. So how can one disconnect that which has never been connected? I am informed that this gang have a requirement now that anyone who joins them, poor unfortunate soul, has to put a name, any name, to one of these pre-typed slips and mail it off to me. Well, it's good for the postal authorities. It's also very good for the police, because I mail the whole lot back to the police at Adelaide, complete with the envelopes, so they can keep a file of these names and the handwriting. As those police have informed me, they are investigating this little gang. I await developments with the greatest of interest. So, Apes of Adelaide, I send you my greetings, and I'm still puzzled how we can be disconnected when we have never been connected. Another person in Vancouver wrote to a friend of his, who promptly informed me, saying that Love Sang Rampa could not be genuine because in one of his books he says he does not like the Irish tax collector. Yet another from Vancouver heard that I was poor, very poor, and this good lady promptly said that I was obviously a fake if I was poor, because if I was genuine, money would come to me and I would be a millionaire. It did not occur to her, apparently, that there are some things more valuable than gold or diamonds. Actually, she's barking up the wrong tree, because a person who really can help others in the occult does not make a charge. He does not put things on a commercial basis. If people want to make a gift of money to help out, well, that's acceptable. But such people are rarer than hen's teeth. There are compensations, though. There are very many nice people who write. I've had a letter telling me that a noted seer is of the opinion and has so stated publicly that Love Sang Rampa has done more for the occult world than any other person on or off the earth. Quite a nice compliment, eh? Certainly, it is one which I very greatly appreciate, because whatever some people think, I am trying to do a job in helping others know what all this is about in this life and after this life. Yes, there are compensations. There are good people. More than a decade ago, when I first came to Canada, I had a letter from a woman, and by psychometry, I judged that she was a nice person and genuine. She asked if she could come and see me. Well, at that time, I had a car. Now I have a wheelchair, and I can't afford a car. So I decided that I would drive to her house and just give her a nice surprise. I did so, and I found a very nice woman indeed, Mrs. Valerie Sorok. During the past 10 years, the friendship and personal liking between her and my family and I has grown to its present stage that she is accepted not just as a friend, not just as someone who writes, but as one of the family. She writes, but we have met her on very many occasions, and wherever we have lived in Canada, she has visited us. She even visited us when we were in Montevideo in the country of Uruguay. Last night, I had a really long-distance call from Mrs. Valerie Sorok, a telephone call because those unmentionable mailmen are on strike here in Canada. So Mrs. Sorok made this telephone call, and she said that as I was writing another book, she would like to have a few questions answered. So I wrote down her questions and I told her that I would answer her in this book if she agreed to have her name as the one asking the questions. By the way, Mrs. Sorok is the perfectionist in English who shudders so violently when she reads my distorted form of prose, and sometimes when she peruses proofs and sees grammatical errors, well, she turns positively pale. But now let us send a greeting to Mrs. Valerie Sorok and deal with her questions. And the first question is, how can one overcome fear? Fear. You must know what you fear. What do you fear? Do you fear the unknown? Until you know what it is you fear, you cannot do anything about it. Fear is a harmful thing. It's a shameful thing. It's a thing which stultifies progress. How to overcome fear? The best way is to think of that thing which you fear. Think about it from all angles. What is it? Why should it affect you? What do you think it can do to you? Is it going to injure you physically? Is it going to injure you financially? Will it matter in 50 years' time? If you carefully analyze your feelings, if you carefully go into the subject of this, why do I fear? You will surely come to realize that there's nothing to fear. I have yet to find anything which can make one fear if one really goes into the matter. Do you fear the police or our old enemy, the tax collector? Do you fear things in the astral world? Well, there's no need to, because I state most definitely, if you analyze this object or this condition or this circumstance which causes you to experience fear, you will see that it is a harmless thing after all. Do you fear poverty? Then what do you fear? Take it out of its dark closet. Is it your skeleton in the closet? Take it out, dust off the cobwebs, and look at the problem from all angles. You will find that fear vanishes. And always remember that if you do not fear, then nothing in this world, or off this world, can harm you. And believe me when I say that people off this world are a lot kinder than the people on this world. Now we come to the second question, which is, how does one know when one is doing right? Well, every person, every entity on this world or off this world has a built-in sensor, a part of the mind which enables a person to know if he or she is doing right. If a person gets drunk or under the influence of drugs, the sensor is temporarily stunned, and the behavior of a person who is drunk or under the influence of drugs can be very bad and can be far worse than would be the case if the person's personal sensor was in working order. You can always tell when you are doing right. You feel right. If you're doing wrong, then you have an uneasy feeling that something is not as it should be. The best way to be sure of knowing if you're doing right or doing wrong is to practice meditation. If you wrap yourself in your meditation robe, you insulate yourself from the rest of the world, and your astral form can become disengaged from outside influence and can give you enlightenment direct from the over-self. If you meditate, you see, it's not just a lump of protoplasm giving you ideas. When you meditate, you actually receive confirmation of your good or bad from your over-self. And so I say to you, if you are in doubt, meditate, and then you will know the truth. Now you have asked me something. You ask, how can one develop extrasensory powers? Well, sad to say, some people never do. Just the same as some people can never paint a picture. Some people cannot sing a song. Or if they do, they're soon told to shut up. Some people cannot do ESP because they are so sure that they cannot do ESP. But if one is willing to try, ESP is easy. You cannot normally do the whole bunch, you know, telekinesis, telepathy, clairvoyance, clairaudience, psychometry, and the whole lot. But if you've been trained in ESP from your 7th year up, then you can do it. But assume now that you want to learn to do some form of ESP. We have to specify something, so let us say psychometry is your choice. You are anxious to practice psychometry. Well, you have to have exercises just as if you are learning to play the piano. You practice the scales, and you go on practicing those silly scales day after day, week after week, and even when you are an accomplished musician, you still have to practice scales. Let us get back, though, to psychometry. You want to learn psychometry, so the best thing to do is to have a week or two just saying to yourself in a positive manner that you are going to be proficient at psychometry, or clairvoyance, or clairaudience, or whatever it is you wish. You visualize yourself putting your hand, usually the left hand, on an object, and you visualize yourself getting a clear picture or a clear impression about that object. For 1 or 2 weeks, then, you fill your waking hours with thoughts that you're definitely going to do this. Then, after perhaps 14 days, you wait until the mailman has come, and you take a letter which he has delivered, and you just gently rest your left hand upon it, before you open it, of course. Rest your left hand upon it, close your eyes, and sit in any relaxed position. Let yourself imagine, later it really will be so, that you can feel some strange influence coming out from the envelope and tickling the palm of your hand and your fingers. By this time, you should be getting some sort of sensation in your left hand. Well, just try to let your mind go blank and see what sort of impression you get. First, it will be crude. It will be utterly rudimentary. You can classify the letter as good or bad. You can classify it as friendly or unfriendly. Then, open your letter and read it and see if your impression was correct. If you were correct, then you will succeed rapidly, because nothing succeeds like success. First of all, try with just one letter, that is, on one day. Next day, try two or three letters, or if you wish, stick to one only, but this time, try to feel what the letter is about. Persevere with it, and as you succeed, you will go on to much better things. When you are proficient in psychometry, and it only takes practice, you will be able to actually visualize or even actually see the person who wrote the letter, and you will know the gist of it without opening the envelope. It is a simple matter, and it merely needs practice. If you are learning to touch type and you peek at the keys, you are putting yourself back. You have to learn to type without looking at the keys. And as you make progress and hit the right keys in the right sequence, you get confidence and you can go faster. It's the same way with psychometry. As you make correct guesses, which are really correct impressions, it strengthens your confidence. And with strengthened confidence, you can find that you are progressing faster and faster and becoming more and more accurate and more detailed. It is hard work, though, because you have to practice and practice and practice. And you have, first, to be alone when you are doing it. Otherwise, if there are people about chattering like a load of monkeys, they will distract you, and you will never do it. So, practice and practice alone until you are proficient. And when you are proficient, you can do it with your hands or your feet, or you can even sit on a letter and know what's inside. Still dealing with Mrs. Sorok, we have her final questions. How can one make sure lessons are learned well enough so we don't have to come and start all over again? Believe me that when you get a lesson which you feel has sunk in, it has indeed sunk in. You want to remember that when you leave this world, you leave all your money behind you, you leave your clothes behind you, and this low vibration physical body as well. But what actually goes with you in place of a bank account is all the good that you have learned. So if you have had a lesson or two, that goes with you, and you have the results of that on the other side. Supposing you're having difficulty with some man. You decide on a certain course of action to bring him to heal, and then you weaken when the time comes for you to implement that course of action. Well, that sets up a negative. It sets up a black mark against you. If you have decided to do a certain thing which you believe to be right, then you must, at all costs, do that thing which you believe to be right. If you start to do it and turn back, then it acts as a negative, it acts as a barrier, and as some great difficulty which later has to be overcome. To answer your question, then, how to make sure that you learn your lessons well enough so that you do not have to come here again. Decide upon what you believe is a correct course of action. And having decided upon that correct course of action, let nothing divert you from your course. Then you will be doing right, and you will not have to come and learn it all over again. You can also practice the old immortal law, do as you would be done by. If you do that, then you have learned the great law of all, and you do not have to come back and start all over again. So, let us say goodbye to Mrs. Valerie Sorok on these questions and turn to something else, shall we? Questions, questions, questions. All right, what is the next question? You write in your books about two Siamese cats, one called Q.E. and the other called Fifi. What happened to them? The lady Q.E. is not upon this earth anymore. She was doing very well, but then I was the victim of a wholly unjustified, entirely unwarranted press attack, and the lady Q.E., who, like me, had had a very hard life, was not able to put up with any more sorrow or persecution. And so the lady Q.E. passed away from this earth. I visit her in the astral, and she visits me. Mrs. Fifi Greywhiskers also has left this earth, but she was old and blind. She was gravely handicapped by the beastliness of humans. She is not handicapped any longer, for she can see, and she has a very, very sweet nature. I visit her too in the astral, and she visits me. These two have their representatives here. One is Miss Cleopatra, a Seal Point Siamese, and I must say that she is the most intelligent animal I've ever met. If one were awarding IQs, one would place her IQ rating very, very high indeed. She is brilliant. The other representative is Miss Tadalinka, and she's a Blue Point Siamese. She is exceptionally kind-hearted and most maternal. She comes into my room at night and really looks after me, and they both are the finest of all companions during the long, sleepless hours of darkness. Never let anyone say that humans are superior to animals, for these two, Cleopatra and Tadalinka, have personalities which any human would raise them to sainthood, and that is truly meant. Another person writes, in one of your books, you imply that the Christian religion is breaking down and there will be trouble in the Vatican in years to come. Don't you think that Christian religion will conquer all? Actually, it's not what I think. That doesn't matter. What does matter is what is present in the probabilities. And according to the Akashic Record of Probabilities, the Christian religion will pass away. Already, Christians, I'm a Buddhist, are saying that God is dead, or God doesn't care, or some such rot. But God is God no matter what you call him. There is a supreme being no matter what you call him. A great weakness of Christianity is that Protestant fights against Catholic, and Catholic fights against everything else. And they're also frightfully sure that there is no way to heaven except through the door of their own particular little church. The Record of Probabilities says that before too long the Christian religion will end and a completely fresh religion will come into being. Many people believe that there are more Christians than any other religion upon this earth. That is nonsense, which can be shown by visiting any public library and consulting a map which gives comparative religious numbers. The Christian religion will end then, and a completely fresh religion will take its place, in which some of the priests, most of the priests, will have a far greater understanding of people than do the present Christian priests, who are scared stiff to discuss anything and who can only talk in platitudes or parables. It's easy for a priest with an absolutely assured income to go on and on to some poor, impoverished sufferer about God will provide. But it's not so easy when you are the poor, impoverished sufferer. With the next religion, there will be many, many improvements. About time, too, isn't it? In passing, and this is entirely my own comment, I really am highly amused about the Salvation Army. These people used to be wonderful to the poor, but my own personal experience is that they are not so wonderful now. Now you get little men and women who, to me, seem to be arrant hypocrites, lording it over those who have had some misfortunes. I know what it's like to be forced to live for a short time in a Salvation Army hostel and to have a little squirt of a man order me about. I know what it's like to have a little runt squeal, "Sing, my man, you have to sing and pray before you have your soup." Let me repeat that many years ago the Salvation Army did wonderful things for the poor, but during the last 25 years they seem to have changed such a lot that it's about time they were disbanded and set to digging ditches or something, so they would know the other side of the coin. That is my personal opinion, based upon more than one actual personal painful experience of the Salvation Army. Reference to an army of any kind, good or bad or very indifferent, brings our next question into its logical position. A questioner wrote, "What is wrong with this world? Why have we failed? Where have we failed? How is it that everyone's hand is against everyone else nowadays? Can you explain that?" Yes, I think so. I think there is no problem in explaining, actually. It's a breakdown in discipline. An army is only an army so long as it has discipline. When discipline fails, an army becomes a rabble. But let us look at it rather more closely. Every person, every community, whether it be a hamlet, a village, a town, a city, or a country, or every world also, has a choice of the right path or the wrong path. It's like a continuous examination. Do people know the answers? Can they make the right decision, the right choice? Can they take the right path? Well, the poor old earth took the wrong path, and what could have been the negation of the age of Kali, in which all the horrors, frustrations, etc. of the age of Kali would have been cancelled out, instead of that, the earth took the wrong path, and the age of Kali is upon us in full force. This is how it started. In 1914, World War I began. Men were sent to the fighting forces, and because of avaricious munitions makers and others of that ilk, women were beguiled into cutting their hair short, putting on trousers, and entering the factories, taking over the jobs formerly held by men. Women went to work. Women sought what they blithely called equality with men. And what utter nonsense is that? Men and women are different. No man has ever produced a baby, and no woman has ever fathered a baby. They are quite different. Each designed for their own purposes in life, in evolution. The job of woman was probably far more important than that of men. Women had equality. Women have always had equality. The supreme job of women was to look after the family and to train the children to be good citizens and good people. When the woman was at home looking after the family, the world was a far better place. There were less crimes, less strikes, less civic disturbances. Women stayed at home, maintained home discipline, and saw that the rising generation had the necessary training and the necessary discipline with which they in turn would take over. But then women entered the factories, entered the shops, they drove buses, they did everything. And what happened? Young children were shoved out into the streets to play, to look after themselves. Young children, almost as soon as they could totter, were left to fend for themselves and go to a drugstore for a hurriedly snatched meal. The weaker characters among these young people, these quite young children, were soon dominated by stronger and harder and more vicious characters in the community. Soon, children were racing about in gangs like pack rats. There is no longer a respect for law and order. A policeman is an object of derision. Everything is done by children to break the law. They lie, they steal, they gamble, and their sexual precociousness makes one wonder what is to happen next. Parents no longer have any real authority over their children. Children stay out at all hours of the night and day, and they are not responsible to anyone. These children flaunt the authority of teachers, and they behave like mad things. They grow up to be gangsters and assassins, and in my considered opinion, the whole responsibility is that of parents who are so busy amassing money that it is an economic necessity that husband and wife both work, and thus the children, the future race, are neglected. As husband and wife both work, there is more money available, so manufacturers put on extra shifts of workers to make more goods, to take some of the surplus money. The goods are carefully made so that they last a certain predictable time only, or utterly lying advertisements preach that it is absolutely necessary to have this or that product to be in. Cars are altered year after year in only their tinny details. They are altered to make last year's cars completely obsolete fashion-wise. Yet underneath, there is the same old clunker rattling along. The same old engine, which really hasn't improved much over the years. All that matters to people now is, are they keeping up with the Joneses better? Or can they go one step ahead of the Joneses? The world has gone mad, and it's all because men and women want to take a country and squeeze it like a lemon. Here in Canada, a member of the Mail Carriers Union, or whatever they call themselves, who have gone on strike, causing distress and hardship for many because they want a 30% increase in their already lavish wages, has gone on the radio and actually broadcast, in by no means cultured tones, that the country is like a lemon, and the unions are going to squeeze the last drop of juice out. Well, as long as that attitude prevails, the country and the world has little hope. The only thing to save the world now is a return to sanity, a return to the realization that the man should be earning the living and the woman should be the mother. The woman should stay at home, doing the most noble task of all, instilling discipline and spiritual values into children, who later will become adults and so in their turn will have to pass on knowledge and training. The world lacks religion. So many religions are busy fighting against each other. The Christian, for example, well, it should be that Christianity is Christianity. Instead, the Church of England and the Church of Rome hail it as a great spiritual victory when they can speak politely to each other. They're all Christians, aren't they? What is wrong with them? Why do they treat members of any other sect as criminals, as people bound for hell? What does it matter if a person is a Jew, a Christian, a Buddhist, or a Hindu? They all believe in their own form of religion, don't they? And as such, their own form of religion should be respected. It seems that the Catholic world is much the same as communism. The communists try to inflict their belief on everyone, regardless of the other person's wishes. The Catholics also try to force their religion down another person's throat, and they utter direful threats of eternal torment, eternal damnation, and all that rot. Believe me when I say there's no such thing as hell. Believe me when I say that all roads lead the same way home. You have to die, whatever your religion. You will die if you have no religion, just the same as the Pope himself. And all that matters is, have you lived your life according to your own personal belief? You won't find a fat priest ready to answer for your sins after. He won't take the blame for anything. You're strictly on your own. What you do and what you do not is not your own responsibility entirely, and you answer to yourself only, not an avenging judge who is going to sentence you to an eternity in hell. No. There's nothing like that. You criticize yourself, and believe me, there's no harsher critic of your actions than yourself. But everyone gets a chance, and a fresh chance, and another chance after that. This is getting away from our subject, however. We need spiritual discipline. A religion is a useful thing for inculcating spiritual discipline, provided the religious leaders are not fighting amongst themselves. All the present-day religions fall down on the job, and so all the present earth religions shall, before too long, pass away like shadows disappearing in the night. And a fresh religion shall come to this earth, which shall help lift people out of the darkness and the misery in which they have now sunk. But the time is not yet. The final battle is not yet. First, there is more suffering, more disturbances in this, the age of Kali. Disturbances caused by World War I, in which women deserted their homes and their children and left those children to run wild on the streets. If you get a wonderfully kept orchard, an orchard on which great care and endless expense has been lavished, and you suddenly withdraw all care from that orchard, soon everything becomes third rate. The fruit no longer has the bloom and the fullness of constant care. Instead, that fruit becomes wrinkled and bitter. People are getting like that. People are now of inferior stock, and soon there will have to be the leaving process again so that fresh blood is brought to the earth. But first there will be more suffering. First, the whole world will be engulfed by a form of communism. Not the communism of China, where even clocks and cars are supposed to run by the illustrious thoughts of Chairman Mao Zedong, and where apparently if a person has some interior obstruction, he just thinks of old Mao Zedong, there is such a disturbance that everything is cleared away immediately. So Earth is in for a sickener. Earth is in for a bad time, let's face it frankly. Everything is going to be engulfed in this form of communism. Everyone will be given a number. They might even lose their names and identities. All these strikes are going to price things out of existence. The unions are gaining more and more power, and eventually their takeover will be a major step towards the ruination of Earth. Eventually, the press lords, like the robber barons of old, will mobilize their private armies of press workers, and they will go to even lower depths in their attacks on people, attacks which are so difficult to stand against when even the meanest type of reporter can write things in the columns of his paper and the attacked person has no redress whatsoever. This isn't justice. This isn't fair. And it's this type of subhuman person who is ruling the earth today and will bring the earth down even lower and lower. Until, having unnecessarily touched rock bottom in this, the age of Kali, the indomitable spirit existing in some people will shudder with the shock and the shame of what has fallen upon the earth, and the spirit will revolt and will take action, which will enable earth and the peoples of earth to rise again. But it may be necessary for the people of space, the gardeners of the earth, to come and give assistance. This is the age of assassination. A great religious leader, Martin Luther King, was assassinated. He was a good man and had much to give this earth. As for the others, well, they were just political people. And I do not want to tread on anyone's toes. History will prove that these were dwarfs raised to giant stature only by the appalling power of their advertising machine. An advertising machine which blew out a lot of stinking hot air and made dwarfs appear like giants. Just as you can get a toy soldier and by placing a light behind him, you can make his shadow giant size on the wall behind. But here too, the toy soldier's shadow is a shadow only, something without substance, something that will soon be forgotten. Martin Luther King was no shadow. He was a good man, working for the good, not only of colored people, but of people of all colors throughout the world. For in persecuting blacks or browns or reds or yellows, the white people who are doing the persecuting are placing a terrible amount of karma upon themselves, individually and collectively. And whatever they are doing now to the colored people will have to be atoned for in suffering and toil and humility. There would still be time to save this earth from its degradation, from its shame. If only women would return to their homes and look after the children and see that those children had proper training, because it is the lack of training which makes it possible for assassins to go about their filthy work. It is the lack of training which enables race riots to take place, and looting and rape. These things were not common in the days when women had more than equality at home, when she occupied this supreme place of honor as mother to her family. It would be much, much better if the criterion of womanhood could be, how well behaved are her children? How contented is her husband? How useful is this woman to the community? Is she an example to others? If so, she's a woman to be proud of. Now, sad to say, a woman is judged by her mammary development, whether they stick up or down, how accessible they are, how many husbands she's had. Sex is a wonderful thing, but this isn't sex. The people who go in for this type of thing are immature. They don't know anything about love, but only about the most functional aspects of procreation. And then, interestingly enough, most of these sex queens are as impotent as a eunuch who has been treated twice by mistake. If all of us could issue a prayer that a great leader would come to earth and help straighten out the mess, that great leader would come, not with flaming sword and embattled hosts, because wars never settle anything. Wars just make misery. Wars make more troubles. It's not necessary to have any of those things. The way of peace is the best, and the best way to get peace is to get women back in the homes, teaching decency to the male members of the family. They can do it, you know. Remember the old saying, a woman who is good is very good, but a woman who is bad is worse than any man could ever be, no matter how bad. End of chapter 5.